Change happens. How we respond to change can make or break us and our careers. Join us for an intimate insight into how senior business leaders face change. The good, the bad, and everything in between. Because whether we like it or not, change happens.
Gone are the days when we used to compartmentalise our work and home lives. The lines between our personal and professional lives have increasingly intertwined and blurred, and certainly never more so than during COVID-19, with many of us working from home and having to socially isolate with the people in our household. To explore some of these aspects, as well as his personal experiences in managing and leading through change, I've asked Managing Director of EY Port Jackson Partners, Dr. Byron Parola, to join me today. Byron is renowned for his commercial acumen with more than three decades of strategy consulting experience, serving CEOs and boards of major companies across the globe, as well as government departments. Surprisingly, though, he actually started his professional life in biochemistry, and as it turned out, managed to get his name on many published papers during that stage of his career. Outside of consulting, though, Byron has extensive pro bono community-based roles, has a very evident service-based paradigm, and is a strong believer that culture and society is built from family. I look forward to discussing all of this with Byron today. Byron, welcome.
Thanks very much for having me.
How are you?
Not too bad. It's a bit of a Groundhog Day for us all.
Yeah, and how have you been, personally throughout the last, say, 6 months?
I think very fortunate is the first answer. I live in Sydney. We have a big family home with only two of my five children still living there, so space is not a problem.
Okay.
So in terms of all the things that are confronting a lot of people, I'm actually pretty blessed. And so I don't have a lot to complain about, really. Having said that, it's challenging times.
It's challenging.
The most uncertain economic environment I've worked in my 35 years professionally. Mm. There's all sorts of challenges in the community that we've not faced in our lifetimes, at least. But I guess I'm pretty lucky.
I want to get to those challenges shortly. Mm. I'm interested in how you've been leading through the last 6 months. There's a lot of stuff that's been going on with you in the business, Port Jackson Partners. But the crisis has certainly we've moved from crisis throughout to a different kind of hybrid, very nuanced, iterative stage of this COVID-19. How have you been leading through those various stages?
Probably not well, frankly. I mean, it's tricky. I think what I've tried to do in the professional environment is bring context and as much clarity as one can give to the team. Mm. So we're a small, our practice, although we're part of EY now, which is massive, our practice is only 50 people. But there are 50 people there who have never lived through this. Most of them have never experienced a recession in any form. Most of them have never seen something like this, and I haven't lived through a pandemic. The task, I think, has been to provide context and clarity and not making false promises, but giving people an insight into how, as leadership, we're thinking about it, what we can tell them about what may happen, and give them whatever wisdom we have as people who have been through a few of these things before, like the GFC and so on. Give them our best instincts and insights, and then be supportive.
Tell me, what surprised you about yourself and maybe others during this period of time?
I saw a great line the other day, which is don't mistake good policy with panic.
Mm.
And I think I've watched people who I thought would panic not panic, and people who I thought would never panic panic. So I think this is sort of this is a particularly unusual situation. I mean, this is an economic crisis driven by a health, a health crisis, which literally unfolded as we were discovering it. And so no one knew how this was going to play out. And we haven't had anything like this in generations. So it was just interesting watching how people dealt with it. And some people I thought would be rock steady, ran to a particular corner. And other people who I thought might be quite unnerved by it became quite steadfast in their resolve to sort of look through it and think through it.
It's an interesting, actually, as you say that. I have a former life. I was in the army, and we used to go and do exercises. And clearly, you have sort of pips on your shoulders, which will designate you as a leader or not. But often there were times where we would be doing certain exercises where Some people would have anxiety about what we're doing. Others would step forward. Yeah. So regardless of what was on their shoulder, you could see some different personalities and true leadership shine no matter what was designated. Byron, I know that relationships are something that you think deeply about and speak broadly on. What are your reflections on the impact of COVID on relationships?
So this is just personal observation, not research-based. I think it's probably grounded us a little bit in what really matters. Mm. I mean, I think it's kind of funny when we're all out there sort of charging busily towards something that we think is really important, and then we have something causes us to pause. I say that funerals, they are an incredibly cheap reminder of what's important.
That's true.
Because you're not dead. I never walk away from a funeral not thinking more deeply about my life.
Yeah.
And so I think this has sort of been a variant of that. And, you know, everyone's been touched by it in some way. So, you know, one of my kids lost their job. Another one took a 35% pay cut just after they took a mortgage out. And my uncle was diagnosed with a brain tumour and died during COVID and couldn't go to his funeral. Two of his five sons couldn't come back from America to see him, let alone bury him. So everyone's been touched with it at some level. And I think, therefore, it's caused us to sort of pause a little bit and just think. So if there's a silver lining in it, it might be that, you know, we slowed down and paused a bit. And that's not saying it's good. No one would wish this on anybody. But I think, you know, in every situation, there's always something you can take from it.
I think that's incredibly true. And, you know, we've had this huge global sort of reset in some ways, you know, around what priorities and what matters. What do you think it means in terms of the future of work and workplaces and life outside of work? What big question, I know.
It's a very current question, as you could imagine. I instinctively have a negative reaction to terms like new normals. Mm. I don't think we're in new anything yet.
Yeah.
I think we're in the middle of something. I think taking long-term projections off, you know, one or two very short-term data points is quite dangerous.
Yeah.
Having said that, I think it's accelerated some trends that were there much more quickly. I remember Greg Hunt, health minister, saying that we've advanced telemedicine more in the last 3 months than we did in the last 5 years.
Absolutely.
And I remember my wife saying, we had a doctor's appointment, specialist appointment, and they called and said, would you mind doing a teleconsultation? And she said to me,
What's that?
No. She said, what don't they understand? She said, she's never touched me in her life. I wait in her waiting room for 40 minutes and we speak across a table. What is unattractive about a teleconsultation? You know, so, I mean, it's kind of interesting.
It's
reframed a number of things. So I think there will be some changes, but I don't believe cities are dead. I don't think people's desires to cocoon in a home and never sort of have a place to be in the workplace. But I think workplaces the trends that have been going on in workplaces will have been accelerated in some places. And there might be some, you know, some lasting resets, but I think it's too early to really tell.
I think I've heard, a lot of discussion around the fact that, you know, we are inherently social beings. One person was saying that, you know, we still find ourselves waving to each other as we end a Zoom call. Those things are so deeply in us. It's what binds us as humans.
Yeah.
Byron, I want to turn a bit to your professional life and your history there. You described yourself previously to me as an average student in school, yet somehow, despite this average declaration, you managed to gain a PhD in biochemistry. You joined McKinsey. You then became the managing director of Port Jackson Partners. Something or some things must have fallen into place at some point along that journey. Can you tell me a bit about some of the turning points for you?
It's true. I was an average student at school. I think the turning points were a couple of things. I think probably I was a late developer. that's probably the truth to it. I found that synergistic space between what I was good at and what I liked.
Mm.
So I've often said to people, if you're trying to find a career or a life's purpose, find the intersection, if you can, between three variables: what you love, what you're naturally good at, and what pays well.
Yes, that's exactly the three I talk about
right?
as well.
And if you're lucky enough to find one that hits all three of those, then that's nirvana.
It.
But if you're going to trade them off, then be conscious about the trade-off. So I chased things I just found partly I loved and what I was good at. So you get that reinforcing virtuous circle going there. So it doesn't feel like work, so you tend to spend more time at it. You enjoy it. It's not a burden. You tend to be naturally good at it. So and the whole thing goes. So I stumbled into science. It was either science or economics. I love science. I loved economics. Look where I am now. But then I started to chase the parts of science that I've naturally felt better. I'm not that good at math, so I stayed away. My hobby was astronomy.
Okay.
But my maths wasn't good enough. And there's no jobs in astronomy. But I was a great chemist. I love chemistry, so I fell into biochemistry. Mm-hmm. And I just chased the areas of that. And then I made choices along the way. So
how did you make choices?
Partly by the combination of, you know, usual thing people do, make a list of pros and cons, yeah. and then overlaid that with gut instinct and then advice. Mm-hmm. So I drew on advice from people I thought who I trusted and respected. So and I had access to. So you don't have a lot of access to a lot of advice when you're young, but my father was a research scientist, professor of medicine. So I used to draw on his advice around things like thesis topics, supervisors and things like that, and got a lot of wisdom I think a lot of people would never have been given.
And what's some of the wisdoms that he imparted?
Don't choose your topic, choose your professor. In other words, find the best person you can work under and go and work under them and don't give a damn what the topic is.
Has that framed your view on talent? Yeah.
Absolutely.
Then?
In fact, yeah. I've seen it in business as well. I mean, one of my experiences was working with one of Australia's most successful business leaders, and they had nothing to answer to in terms of their capability, reputation, et cetera. But what I observed was they surrounded themselves with three of the smartest independent directors you could possibly bring, one of the best investment bankers, tax lawyers and consultants as their non-executive directors on the board. And I watched them take really close attention and careful advice. And that lesson of, you know, basically surround yourself with smart people and then listen has been something that's resonated and formed me as the way I've tried to work. So I think, you know, find people who've got real wisdom and expertise. Doesn't mean you have to do what they say, but then, you know, get their advice and then fold it in. Mm. And then also be prepared to trust your gut instinct. So a few times I made decisions that I thought were right in their head, but having made them instinctually, they felt uncomfortable very quickly. So I'd walk
you'd
back
change
from
them.
And yeah, and it, I went with that. And I think sometimes, I say this to people quite often, sometimes you have to actually walk through the door before you realise it was the wrong door and then you need to be prepared and brave enough to step back out. And so make sure you've got the option to step back out.
Right. And so that's an interesting one around walking through the wrong door, because sometimes when people, you know, walk through that door and they go, well, I've walked in, I'm in the door now,
yeah,
so I
think
I better keep going.
You can do it in a mind game. So I've said to people, for example, put yourself, just imagine, stop thinking about making the decision and tell yourself you've made the decision and
right.
then go home for the weekend.
And sit in it.
And sit in it and tell people you've done it. Tell them you've made the decision and then watch what happens. And, you know, sometimes you feel better and better and better and better about it, and other times you think, you know, you come back on Monday morning, you think, you know what, I'm more uncertain than I was on Friday.
Yeah. But so then you have to say, just kidding, I didn't really make that decision.
Yeah, well, you haven't actually.
Yeah.
And the people around you that, you know, well, if they care about you, they won't care.
They're like, is this another one of those pretendies,
you know,
Byron?
John Maynard Keynes, that great line is, you know, but you've changed your, I forgot what it was, but, you know, he completely changed his perspective on something, and he was called out for it. And he said, when the facts change, I change my mind. What do you do?
So there was a pretty pivotal change in your professional career when you decided to make that leap from working in biotech to working in business, another door to walk through. Mm. How did you make that decision? Why did you make that change? And what was that change like for you?
The reason I made the change was I was working in a centre of excellence in gene technology in Adelaide, so at the University of Adelaide. So it was one of the preeminent places to work in Australia in biochemistry at the time. And they actually ran a biotech company out of the department. Mm. It was called Breezer Technology. And because I had this natural interest in business, I found myself over time in my last year of the PhD becoming more interested in the business of science, or as much interested in the business of science as the science of science. And I recognised that scientists made pretty lousy managers, so they weren't trained in business, and there was a lot of biotech startups going broke because they were being run by scientists. And I thought, well, if I need to jump the bench, as I use the term, I can't face doing an MBA after a PhD. Just felt like too many years at uni. Mm. So I thought I'd go and get a job in business for anyone who would take me. And I had an uncle who was a senior executive in BHP at the time, and he was the only person in business in my family. So I turned to him for advice. Yep. And just said, you know, should I write to this company, that company? I read the Fin Review every day as a PhD student, and every time I found an interesting company in the Fin Review, I wrote to them.
And that would have been the slow mail stuff, man,
right? That was. I mean, I was pretty high tech in those days. I had a golf ball printer on the back of a dual floppy disk 360K, okay. You know, IBM XP, you know. So I was right up there, but, you know, you had to look them up in the white pages,
mm-hmm.
You know, find their address, you know, write
the letter.
Literally
go to post offices, buy a stamp.
Go to the post office, put a stamp on it, and then wait for a return letter. I think I wrote 150. I don't even remember writing to them, but I wrote to McKinsey.
Mm-hmm.
I just received a job offer from Accenture, which was Arthur Anderson, MIC, Management Information Consulting Division, in the early days, and I was going to become a programmer in there. And I had this letter from McKinsey waiting for me, sort of saying, next time you're in Sydney, and I was in Adelaide, you know, let us know and we'll give you a job interview. And I almost binned it, called my uncle. He said, McKinsey's not a bad shop, give them a call. I honestly didn't know what they did. I didn't actually have the wit to ask him.
Right.
Because I'd written so many of these things and everything was no thanks, no thanks, no thanks. So I was just, you know, going through a fairly big filter. But I called them. They flew me up the next day. I did 8 case studies. I'd never heard of a case study. So talk about, you know, forget prepping like the kids do today with, you know, case competitions and all sort of stuff. I just walked in and had 8 interviews, literally back to back, and thought at the end of the day, how good is this? People pay you to do this for a living. How cool. Because I was a problem solver. I was a researcher.
Right.
And, you know, I just got thrown problem after problem all day. And they were fascinating. I knew nothing about them.
Mm. But they got your genuine curiosity about this.
Yeah. I would have butchered half of them. Mm. I mean, I had no idea. Mm. I mean, one of them was, you know, forecast the electricity demand in New South Wales for the next 10 years. I mean, what the hell would I know about how to do that? And I completely butchered it. But
must have done something right.
I must have done something right, yeah. I found a really interesting career. I found a way to get from science, drawing on my problem-solving skills, which is what McKinsey was buying, and then had to retool. I mean, I didn't know the language.
How did you retool?
The hard way. You banged your head. I mean, they gave a bit of training. They had one good thing they did for people like me is they stuck us in what they called a mini MBA for a month.
Right.
And we were taught finance, a little bit of marketing.
It's a whole new world on language though, isn't it?
Oh, well, you know, my first day at McKinsey, somebody handed me an annual report for North Broken Hill, and said the mining company that doesn't exist anymore, and said, can you do a break even on their mine? And I was sitting there with holding this annual report thinking, why is it broken and how do I make it even? And I didn't know what the words meant. I mean, the idea of what a hedge or an option was, you know, all those sorts of things we take for granted if you've been in the industry.
It is funny for those. I mean, when I speak to people who aren't in the consulting game and they're like, what are these words that you are using? And I remember when I started, and I also didn't come from a consulting background, and I walked in and someone said to me, can you talk to those slides? And I said, why would I talk to the slides? I think I want to talk to the people.
So
another major change in your life, and this one's very, very recent, yes. Close to both of our hearts, was your decision to join EY via an acquisition. Mm. I'm sure there was logic and emotion caught up in all of that. How did it happen? Was it opportunity? Was it planned? What was it like making that kind of decision and speaking to your team about it?
That's a big question. Now that's another whole podcast. So it was a natural intersection of, I think, two groups, not knowing each other necessarily and heading towards the same hill, where there's a natural synergy. So we had built over 30 years of practice that I think was well regarded in the Australian market as a very good strategy house, you know, high quality advice to government and corporates. The question is, where do we go next with it?
Mm.
And we weren't driven by growth. We weren't building a firm to sell. We had no intention. This was not a classic spin out, you know, build and sell. And every year we'd be approached by somebody who wanted to buy us, and we've never felt any interest in doing it. But we intersected EY at this point, who had an aspiration, which I think all the firms do, to actually try and build a tier one strategy house within their firms, but actually was going about it in a way that we actually thought was credible. And that's what we hadn't seen before. So I remember saying to Harsha, when he first called and introduced himself, I said, look, I'm going to waste an hour of your time, but I'm really happy to come and meet, because I don't think this will go anywhere, but I'm very happy to meet with you and get to know each other. And that's the way we've always approached it. And almost without exception, we walked out of those meetings after an hour, and it was respectful and interesting, but it recommitted us to our model of independence. Mm. This one, I walked out and I thought, that's interesting. And then we spent about 8 months really testing that together.
So huge decision to join EY? I mean, in and of itself, a really big pivotal point in your, I guess, professional career and for the careers of those who work with you. Many months in the making, so many months so, in fact, that a global pandemic kicked in somewhere along the way.
Yeah.
How did that play out? Did it have an effect in there? What was the effect of that? I mean, you're a great strategist, but I'm sure you didn't see that coming.
No, I didn't. There's not many things I haven't predicted in life, most of the important ones, in fact. I'm not a forecaster. So we were fortunate we had spent enough time together at the leadership levels of our practice and with EY that when the pandemic hit, we had largely decided to do this. And then it took courage of our respective convictions not to back away. Because, you know, everyone, the modus operandi at that moment became roll up the shutters and don't do anything.
Yep.
But I guess we were fortunate that we'd had enough water under the bridge together to actually follow that through. The tricky part was actually, you know, it's now, where are we now, September, we finalised the, you know, the quote-unquote transaction in June, early June. But we were actually working together as though it had been done for 2 months beforehand because we just knew we were going to do it. We started quietly planning even though it wasn't public and it became public in May. But as a partnership, we have not sat around a table together since before we decided to formally vote to do this. So the vote to do this was done on video.
Yeah.
The firm of 50 people who are very tight and think of themselves a bit like a family, and I don't mean that in the kooky sense, but we really have each other's backs. We care deeply about each other. We have not met as a firm. This was announced to my colleagues over video. I mean, if you told me I was going to do that at the beginning, I would have said, you're mad. I mean, you know, that's insane. So it's not a radical refit for us trying to bring what we bring into EY as part of helping EY build what it wants to do, which is quite exciting, which is to build a genuine tier one strategy house. And it will be different. That's a worthy goal. I mean, that's something that gets me up in the morning.
Right. And you do like to set big goals for yourself, don't
you? Yeah.
What are some of the big goals that you've set for yourself in life? Come on.
So I wake up in the morning and I think, not every morning, sometimes I'm just glad to be alive. But my life's thing is set a goal that matters, that you know you can't deliver, but if you get anywhere towards it, it'll make a difference. So stupidly at the end of my honours year, I set myself a goal of, I didn't tell anyone this, by the way, but I have a Nobel Prize by 30.
Nobel Prize?
Yeah, in science.
Well, how'd you get on with that?
Oh, terribly. Got nowhere near it. But the aspiration was to drive me. When I joined McKinsey, the quiet little fact I found out what was the fastest anybody was elected to partner. And I figured that was a relevant benchmark. So what I try to do is set
How'd you get on with that?
I left before partnership and I wasn't going particularly quickly. I mean, you know, I was a biochemist for God's sake. I'm surprised they kept me for the first year. But the point behind it, it's not driven from an external recognition thing. It's like if you're going to get up and swing the bat, you know,
we'll have a big swing
it with intention.
Yeah.
So, you know, call me crazy, but the idea of taking what we spent 30 years carefully nurturing in Sydney, or out of Sydney in the Australian market, and work out how with colleagues around the world who I met before we decided to do this to know that they were like quality people in the Parthenon group, within EY, to say that actually I want to have a crack at wiring this up into something with the power of a big four firm behind it, but with the quality in the strategy thinking space that we would expect to have and require to have to be who we are. You don't get many chances in life to do that.
Sure.
Right? And so there was put in front of us. And so, you know, I'm a bit of a drug addict for big, hairy, audacious goals, even at my later in life years. And so here we are.
Here we are. You know, it's so funny as I listen to you because many years ago I came across a person who ended up playing quite a pivotal role in my life and he said, if we're going to work together, I need to know a bit more about you. He said, if you were to die tomorrow, God, this is sounding really morbid, this conversation, but if you were to, what would it say on your epitaph? Tell me what your tombstone would say. And I said, Janelle McMaster, I said this with pride, Janelle McMaster, under promises, over delivers.
Right.
And he's like, that's a shocker. And I was so crestfallen. And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, mine is always punched above his weight. And it made me realise at that point in time that I was always holding myself back. And I really did change from that point on. So you're setting a goal that matters resonates to me. And you know, it took me a while to get there myself.
Yeah.
So tell me, you're the leader of a great strategy house and you have been for a long time. You work with great strategists. What makes someone a great strategist? And is it something that one can learn?
If I had that recipe, then look, I actually don't know, to be perfectly honest. I think there are three or four elements. You've got to have intellectual curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
What makes the difference in strategy is actually finding the thing that nobody else saw.
Mm.
Because really what you're trying to do in strategy is out-compete or do something that hasn't been done before. So you've got to actually find something that doesn't exist, right? And that's the sort of the research. So you've got to have that intellectual curiosity.
Yeah, right.
The second thing you've got to be, I think you've got to be, incredibly commercial, or I'm not quite sure what the equivalent in government is, but pragmatic. You know, like you've got to have this sort of real groundedness.
Mm.
It can't be theoretical.
Mm.
It's got to be something that actually will work, you know, is actually can be done. I mean, I see lots of young strategy consultants get very frustrated with their clients because, you know, if they just did our advice, you know, just followed our advice, it's really simple. And I think you have no idea how hard it is to move an organisation of 20,000 people from A to B, you know, when you've got, you know, shareholders on your back and you've got, you know, regulatory complications around you and you've got, you know, balance sheet issues, you know.
Understanding how to apply it.
So there's got to have a pragmatic, what I call commercial acumen, just, you know, a street smart commercial instinct. They've got to be bright. There's an intelligence that you need in there, and it's and various forms of intelligence. But they've got to have a standout. They've got to have a spike somewhere in their skill set, and they've got to be tenacious because you got to chase the problem, and it's painful. And you've got to be able to cope with the fact that a lot of people find it really hard to get up in the morning and go to do a job they actually don't know what to do.
Mm.
But you do that when you're doing strategy.
Where does diversity play in there? I'm just thinking, you know, being able to look at things from multiple lenses, different perspectives, so how does that play out?
We're generalists. So the diversity generalists, there's a great book out written recently I reckon everybody in my profession should read called Range.
Who wrote that?
It's written by David Epstein, and it's an easy read, and it's, I think, a really good challenging to the hyper-specialised world we're currently in at the moment.
Awesome.
The value of the generalist is largely lost in a highly specialised, increasingly specialised world, but a lot of the time what we're doing in strategy is actually lifting broad insights from different areas and seeing the insight from it, not just folding it over, but there's an insight. So, yeah, you're sitting there with a steel company and says, oh, this is actually a bit like the pet food problem we were working on last week.
Mm.
And everyone looks at you around the table and I was like, what the hell are you talking about, pet food? But there's an insight and a trigger from an experience.
Yeah, the ability to connect
some. And so, you know, our people, you can see the diversity in our people. They range from, you know, psychologists to engineers to, you know, marketing backgrounds to, you know, arts graduates.
Right.
You know, they tend to come from more analytical professions like engineering, finance and so on, but we have a broad range of people, but also an incredible diversity of the type of people we are in terms of our interests and so on. I think it helps.
Mm. Turning a bit to your personal life, you've been a very firm believer in supporting your own personal values and finding a work-life balance early on in your career. I know that shaped some of your decisions. Do you see the experience that we're currently moving through as a positive in showing the possibilities of better work-life balances, given that we've got these forced working from home scenarios?
I'd like to say yes, but I'm not sure is the honest answer. I mean, I think the trick with work-life balance, I'm probably the worst person. If my wife was here.
Yes, what would she say?
She'd say, get some balance, boy. Life is all about trade-offs. If you think you can have everything, you're kidding yourself. So you have to make choices and you have
not
to make...
Not at the same time, that's for sure.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, I'd love to have been an Olympic skier, but I didn't, you know, I don't have the skills and I don't have the time to put into it, but I love skiing. But I, you know, I'm now 60 and my skiing days are going to rapidly diminish because I'll break something if I go out and ski the way I used to. So there's trade-offs. I've made choices along the way through. The biggest choices we make tend to be where we trade off the relationships and the people that matter for things that are important, other things that are important to us. So I think working from home can provide a reset for that. I mean, it has for us a little bit. I mean, I've enjoyed actually working from home to some degree. I found it hard in other areas. My wife and I are both working from home together at the moment, so we see each other more often. We actually have lunch occasionally together, which is usually just passing something to the other on a video conference. But anyway,
it's still something.
It's more than work. I think so. I think so. But you have to choose work-life balance. I mean,
what do you mean by that?
Well, work's a bottomless pit. Family's a bottomless pit.
Yes,
there's more you can always give, and so I think you've got to actually make active choices about them rather than expect somebody to solve it for you, because they're intensely personal choices. So I think there's a friends of ours we know have 10 kids. Which is an amazing thing.
Whoa.
Yeah, in today's world.
I thought your five was...
No, my five's extraordinary. Most
you're actually
minds.
An underachiever here.
But yeah, absolutely. and if I had could have 10 kids like this husband and wife had 10 kids, I'd have them in a nanosecond. They're the most beautiful family. But somebody asked this woman once, you know, but how do you know which one to love? Which is a great question, right?
Oh, okay. There's your intellectual curiosity.
Yeah, and she's, the answer was, it was life-changing for me. She said, the one that needs it most at the moment.
Oh.
And I think that's so the trick is, you know, when you're trading off work and life, it happens at big levels, like, you know, do I take this job or do I don't take this job? Do we move? Do we don't move? Do I travel? Do I don't travel? But it happens every morning and it happens every evening. You know, like last night, we're sitting around the table and I picked up my phone and my wife said, put it down, the kids will be gone in 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Right? That's a choice, right? And so COVID didn't change that choice. That choice is mine. So I think the working from home is actually opening our eyes to to aspects of it, but you have to choose it and you have to decide. So we sort of say in you know, you've got to be intentional about your life, not just a cork bobbing on the tide, hoping you'll wash up on the right beach. I mean, it helps to put you on the right waterway, if you want to take that analogy forward, but you've still got choices all over the place every day.
With that in mind, Byron, you know, with making those active choices, family being such a big part of your personal values, what do you take from that into the teams of people that you work with, the business that you've created? How do you foster that sort of philosophy in the workplace?
I mean, it's probably pretty motherhoody type statements, to be honest. I mean, you treat people like you'd want to be treated. Yeah, I'm 60 this year. Mm. I've been doing this for 35 years. I'm employing new graduates who are younger than my children.
Yeah.
And this is going to sound a little bit goofy, but I think of them as, you know, I'd hope an employer would think of my children as a right. young person trying to make their way in life rather than somebody who's there to do my bidding, you know, or our bidding as a firm.
Yeah.
And it's the same with the teams. You know, every one of my team members have got a personal life, a personal backstory I may not be aware of that's happening in their lives.
But do you actively then sort of give them messages around
we sit as a team. Every time we form a new team, so we work in teams. Every time we form a new team to go on and, you know, to start working with a client, that team sits down and talks about how do we work together? You know, what's happening in our personal lives? You know, obvious things like who's taking leave. But, you know, we've got some people who, you know, they value exercise in the morning. Some people are, if I don't get 8 hours sleep, I can't function. And other people are, you know, as long as I can pick the kids up from 3 to 5, I don't mind working late, but that's sacrosanct for family meals or whatever it might be. And so the trick is to work out, you know, okay, let's make this work together. And you sort of can give that lip service, but then you've got to honour it.
Yep.
And I think, you know, just the way we do with the people we really care about in our personal lives, which is, you know, tends to be close friends and family, I think we should treat our colleagues, you know, the same way. So I think it's pretty simple, but it's actually hard to do. And you've got to create a certain level of vulnerability in the work to really let people feel free to say that, you know, something that they mightn't think it's unreasonable to say. You know, it takes a bit of courage sometimes to sort of, you know, voice a personal preference as a team member, knowing that that's not the preference of your boss's work style.
Yeah, sure. Husband and father of five.
Yeah.
I imagine there's much negotiations that goes on in your household.
Yeah.
And
the dog.
Okay. So how do you deploy your strategic skills to get what you need in that household? Do you?
No.
So you leave them at work, don't you?
My wife once said to me, don't treat me like one of your analysts. When I was trying to just logically problem solve on the incredibly emotional situation we were dealing with at the time.
Yes.
You are who you are. So you bring all that into every relationship. But it's different. It's a different situation. So we don't have a family plan or family strategy. God help me. It's a bit like leading a professional services firm in the case of my wife, we're life partners together. Mm. Yeah, we've made a public commitment to be with each other until death do us part, and better for better or for worse. And we've had better or for worse times.
Yep.
So, you know, there's a lot of things you need to do to make that journey work. And with the kids, our responsibility is to bring them into well-functioning contributors to society. And so working out what each one, they're all very different, incredibly different. You know, one's doing a PhD, another's a Harley Davidson mechanic.
All right.
Another one's right now, today, out at Bondi on placement as a paramedic. Another one's a construction project manager, and another's taking his gap year trying to work out what he's going to do.
Tough time to take a gap year.
It is a tough time to take a gap year. But they're all different individuals making their way. So you bring everything you have to that. But it's not a work problem.
Mm. So what are the maybe two or three of the biggest lessons you've learnt over your professional career that you sort of take forward with you, that you impart to others? What are the standout lessons for you?
There's a really good line that I've learnt that helps, I think, with the personal relationships, whether they are in your family, in your community, or in the workplace, which too few of us ask, which is whose needs are being met.
Okay.
Every time you're in engagement, whose needs? So if I take it into a professional world, I'm a service provider to clients as an advisor, but I'm also naturally conflicted. They pay me to be there.
Yep.
So, you know, whose needs are being met when I'm proposing to do some work with them?
But is that wrong though?
But ultimately you've got to be guided about who you're serving.
Okay.
And I think there's a question there about, you know, am I being self-serving in this relationship or am I being of service to others? Mm-hmm. And you're not a doormat. You know, there's a certain civil, but you've got to watch yourself. So whose needs are being met, I think, has actually been quite a good, you know, rudder for me in life. Am I really doing this for my own self-interest, or am I being more motivated by my self-interest, or, you know, for those I am in service to, family, community, clients? I think that's been a useful one. I think the other thing is humility. It's one of the values of our firm. People think of us as being, you know, super smart or something because we're a well-respected strategy house. We've got really bright people in our firm, but we walk into our clients and we know less about their business than they know.
Yep.
We're not industry experts. Mm-hmm. What we are skilled in a particular area, and it's quite a narrow area. And so, you know, learning how to take what we're good at confidently but not arrogantly or presumptively and partner with people even when we think they might be wrong or they think we might be wrong.
Yep.
To actually work to a solution that actually is right. The humility is a pretty, not a very favoured word these days because it sounds like you're, you know, being a shrinking violet. I mean, we're not shrinking violets.
Mm.
We're fiercely independent advisors, but we have a deep sense of, you know, we aren't the smartest people in the room. We don't know what's best all the time. Mm. We're here to help you be successful. I think that's a really good a guide.
It is a favourite word for me, by the way. I actually love the word humility.
Well, we found it in EY, actually. It's one of the reasons why I think we've resonated together. It's sort of, you know, it's a fine line between being confident and arrogant. And humility humility keeps you grounded. And frankly, if we're honest with ourselves, we've got plenty of things to be humble about.
Yes, I think that's
None
right.
of us are perfect beings. Look, and the last thing, and this is, I think this applies to all areas of life, which is when we're faced with a challenge and a decision to make, are we confident enough and brave enough to make the decision, or do we can kick? And can kicking, I think, is we see it too often in the corporate world in strategy, which is it's a hard problem. It's risky to pull it off. We sort of know we need to deal with it, but
we'll
get
to it later.
We'll leave it for somebody else.
Yeah.
You know, it's messy, it's risky. And can kicking, I think, is it doesn't serve anybody. And you can kick in your personal life. There's an issue between yourself and the kids, or you, but it's a bit hard to open up and go into. So you can't, you dance around it and you pretend it's not there, but it doesn't build anything. And it leaves you a bit hollow and leaves the business or the relationship, if it's personal, weak. So I think don't be a can kicker. And that can sometimes cost you.
That's right.
The last three fast questions on change to finish the podcast.
I like to finish each of these interviews with three fast questions, a bit more on the lighthearted side.
Right.
What's the misconception that most people have about you?
That I'm smart.
Okay.
I'm not that smart.
Nope.
No, I work hard.
You had me fooled.
I work hard.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. What's one guilty pleasure?
Chocolate. Chocolate is my guilty
That's
pleasure.
Your thing? Okay. Yeah. And what's one thing that you're hopeless at?
No, I'm hopeless at names.
Names?
Oh, yeah, this is really bad.
This is where I feel like I
literally think. if I'm there with my wife and five kids and somebody walks up and I have to introduce them to all of them, I will drop a name. I mean, quite seriously.
You'll lose one of the kids' names out of the fight.
If you ask me, I'll go blank. I know the name. I'm literally my brain freezes. Some names are terrible.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I won't take offence the next time.
No, that's fine, Mary.
Well, Byron, thank you so much for your time today. So many things I've taken away from our conversation. Some of those include setting a goal that matters. I love that, you know, that it really does stretch you to make a real difference with your time. I really love the following and investing in talent. You have followed great talent. You've invested in great talent and the power of that. And one thing that's really struck me is, you know, not for any of us to not abdicate from our own responsibilities, that whether that's in making active choices in your own life, in your work-life balance, or your contribution to culture in your workplace and in society. I love that the recognition of, you know, tough times that we find ourselves in COVID has actually given us an opportunity to pause and reflect on what matters. And I love your question of, you know, asking ourselves whose needs are being met. And I think when we have that front of mind, we understand, we bring a service mindset to what we do. So plenty of things there, Byron. It's been great to have a chat today. Thank you for your time.
Fun. Thank you.
Cheers.
The Change Happens podcast from EY, a conversation on leading through change. Discover more where you get your podcasts.